Raised Rowdy. All right, everybody. Welcome to the Raised Rowdy podcast. My name is Kurt Ozon.
I'm Nick Tressler.
And we have the Wilder Blue on today. Welcome, boys.
Hey, yeah. Baby.
Happy to be here.
Two-fifths.
Yeah, two-fifths. Well, also, welcome back, Kurt. First podcast back in a while.
I haven't done this in a while.
Nice.
He's just been touring Europe, I guess.
Sure.
You know?
Yes, why not? So
it'd be a little podcast rusty with us.
Yeah.
It's good to see you guys.
Good. Are you back on American schedule yet? Back on the fast food and the bad TV
Crystal
stuff?
Burgers?
Not fast food yet, but back on the I've definitely got my sleep figured out, I think. Which is cool because, like, when you go over there, you're extra fucked. But when you come back, you're like 9 p.m., you're like, I'll go to bed. And you get up at like 7 a.m., you feel like an adult. So I'm not like fully back onto like being up till 2 every night.
Sure.
But like,
you're not on musician time yet.
Yeah. Which feels great. Anyway, yeah. Good to see you guys. Last time, man, we did this, we were in the belly of a football stadium.
Yeah. That's right.
I mean, this podcast studio is okay, but it's not as cool as a football stadium. I'll tell you that.
We don't have catering either.
Yeah.
No catering, no white couches.
God, yes. There was really good catering there. Yeah. I mean, I don't know catering because I'm not like a celebrity or whatever, but it was really good.
Well, what have y'all been up to since we've seen you last?
Man, same old stuff. Just making music, playing music, trying to convince people that our music's worth listening to and seeing. Kind of the usual.
It shouldn't be hard, I feel like. Yeah, it shouldn't be hard. Congrats on the new record, by the way.
Yeah. Thank you, man.
It's been really fun to listen to it, and it's... Sounds like Wilder Blue, but a little. There's a little bit of expansion there.
Wilder Blue plus Max.
You got me. You beat me to it.
What is that?
It's a South Park reference. But for this record, we did bring in some outside players. We felt like some of the songs needed a little fiddle and steel. And
Amen.
And then since we were doing that, we brought in a real keys player as well, Travis Bishop. Played keys because all of us
we can tinkle
funk
a little
around on the keys, mm-hmm. But Travis, so they were all guys that we knew or knew of, you know, from the music scene down in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Travis Yunt, Harrison Yunt played steel. He plays with Kojo, and then Cody Angel was a guy that used to play with Bolin that we kind of knew from the Texas music scene. He lives here in Nashville now. So those two guys played steel. And a buddy of mine named Steve Auburn played fiddle. The Wilder Blue is already basically my dream band, but I do love me some fiddle and steel.
Dream band plus.
Dream band plus fiddle and steel. It was fun. Plus, it was just something different to try for album number 5. The five of us played all the instruments and everything. So it was fun to try to paint with some different colors.
Well, Brent played a little guitar on third record, I think.
I guess so, yeah.
Where'd you guys cut the record?
Sonic Ranch, down in El Paso. We returned to the scene of the third record crime, and this time without Brent Cobb, unfortunately.
I was going to ask if you guys were self-produced? Or?
Yeah, we did this one on our own, which it was a lot of fun. It's always a lot of fun. It can be a bit of a struggle sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Democracy is messy, man.
Democracy is messy. Slow and messy.
Five it's cooks in the kitchen.
Well, and yeah. we brought these other cats in knowing that they're all really good at doing what they do. And so we tried to encourage them to also be like, don't be afraid of pitching whatever, and we'll just cross those bridges when we get there. And
yeah.
We got a lot of good stuff out of that.
We made them honorary band members at that time, and we told them to just jump on in there.
Yeah.
But that's fun, dude. Like, if you can't go to the studio and just do whatever you want to do, what's the point of being an independent poor musician?
I mean, come on. Amen, brother. Yeah, dude. No doubt.
Yeah.
Especially, it's like you're not cutting it on Music Row, so it's not like you're, 10 to 1 or whatever, like getting the same dudes to play on everything. And, I love those dudes. I am one of those dudes sometimes.
You're those dudes. Yeah.
Right. You're that dude.
But it's like when you and your buddies are like living in the guest house behind the studio or wherever it is, I don't know how the living quarters worked out.
Sonic Ranch
like
is awesome because it's one of the few places where everybody can just have their own room, so you can just disappear if you don't have anything to do. Just disappear for a few hours. Or like there was some harmonica parts that ended up on the record that Lyndon and I recorded at 2:30 in the morning after we'd been drinking all day. Everybody else went to sleep,
yeah,
just us. Recorded some stuff, forgot about it, and then it popped back up in the mix.
Stumbled to your room.
Yeah.
And then they cook for you. They got these sweet Mexican ladies that cook you three meals a day.
Gosh,
they'll do your laundry. They got all the gear you could ever want. I mean, the Sonic Ranch is kind of paradise for me. They have every time we leave, I'm like bummed.
Yeah,
they got to kick me out. Like, you need to leave. You or else pay us more money.
I want to be in y'all's band. That sounds awesome.
It's pretty fun, man.
We might be in the market for a steel player. Who knows?
I know. Yeah, after this record,
yeah,
the right? Extra Mac plus plus. Then you
yeah.
know,
yeah.
When you're whenever you're tired of playing in your stadiums and castles and stuff, you just come on back to the small to medium clubs there with you us. Go. Schlep your own gear.
We got plenty of small medium
reconnect
clubs on the calendar.
With what it's all about. Drive the bus yourself. Fix all the flats yourself. Get out there and stack cases with us. You'll love it.
Hell yeah!
I was just at a festival and Shenandoah was playing and Marty was driving the bus and I'm like, hell yeah! You know, yeah. Takes you back. You know.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm. Are you guys still riding that?
Oh yeah,
the bandwagon.
What would you call that thing? I don't even know.
Toter home. It's a bandwagon. It's made by Bandwagon. A lot of people call that style a toter home. It's an 8-bunk RV built on a Freightliner.
Just frame. Toting our frustrations all the way across the country.
So is there only 8 of you guys in there or what?
Okay, yeah, only 8.
Well, I just mean like because people travel with a lot of crew and stuff. So
yeah, no, we're as skeleton as we can get, I guess.
When we bring a driver, which we sometimes do, he sleeps on the couch or in the cab.
Yeah,
because
that could be you.
We're out of space.
That could be you, Kurt.
I need my beauty sleep, obviously. You know what I mean? Oh, that's great. Well, we've talked about the record. Why don't we dive into it a little bit and talk about the title of the record?
Yeah.
Yeah. Zane?
Who came up with Cinco? Was that you?
No, I don't think so.
Oh,
okay. I don't think so because I didn't want that to be the title of the record.
Right, yeah, it wasn't you.
I think it just ended up on the list because it was, you know, I hate to say it was easy or cheap or convenient or something, but it is our fifth record. There's 5 of us.
Five of us in the band.
Yeah, that's why it got so many votes, because it's kind of easy.
I wanted some kind of a Spanish word in the title for some reason, just because down there at Sonic Ranch, you're right on the border. It's very, there's a lot of Spanish being spoken on the thing, and I thought our music was a good soundtrack to that vibe down there. And so I was trying to think of like one English word and one Spanish word maybe or something. And somebody threw out Cinco, and because it was the fifth record, there's 5 of us in the band, and because it had, for me, had that southwestern...
built-in southwesternness.
Built-in, yeah, Mexican... Because I do think this record has kind of a southwestern vibe to it.
Totally.
Somewhat, yeah.
Yeah, it's like parts of it are like Marty Robbins or something, and then parts of it's like more traditional country, and then some of it's sort of like, I don't want to say like disco country or like maybe like 70s country, and then some of it's like classic rock Eagle stuff.
Yeah.
I just feel like there's like a vibe for like any mood I could have on that record. Like I put it on, and it's just like takes you on a journey.
Love that. Love to hear that.
I've heard somebody say that listening to a Wilder Blue album is like, you don't have to make a mixtape because we are the mixtape.
Yes, that's exactly how I feel.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm like, is this, there's parts of it I'm like, okay, Pink Floyd in here, you know?
Yeah.
And like I said, like the Ballad of the Gunslinger kind of vibe.
Right.
You know? It's awesome. Yeah. It's cool. It's like, if I want to listen to music, then I could just put your record on. If I want to listen to country music, and I don't have to be too specific about which genre. Mm. Then I'm like, just put this on, and everything sounds great.
Yeah,
all the songs are great. All the playing's great. It's a great record.
Thanks, man.
Yeah.
You know, that's one of the things that often gets bandied about when we're in the studio is the word cohesion, which I hate. I hate that word. I hate that word so much because I just don't buy it. I don't buy cohesion as a thing to shoot for because it doesn't make sense to me if every song wants what it wants, you know? And it's really, to me, it's always been more about will these songs go together regardless of how they're produced? You know, I listened to some old records, like I listened to Dwight's In Time a couple months ago, and some of those songs are way off the wall relative to other ones on the same record. But it doesn't sound, you know, like it doesn't work or make sense to me, so I'm always wary of trying to shoot for cohesion because I don't think it really gets to the heart of any given tune, you know?
And some of these songs, like you, like I read, were written in 2020, and some were written more recently. And
some are even older than that, right? What, When He's Out of Sight is probably, yeah, what, 10 years old now?
It was like 2016. Yeah, I wrote that in 2016. So we, on this record, we've got songs that none of us wrote. We've got songs that we got a song that the band members wrote that I didn't write. We've got songs that I co-wrote with the band members or some outside writers. And then we have a few that I wrote by myself, some of which are new, like Texas Women is a newer one. And then some of which are old, like When He's Out of Sight. When He's Out of Sight, I had that in my back pocket towards the end of the Zane Williams days. And I remember when we were putting the Wilder Blue together,
it was in that Dropbox folder y'all sent me of stuff.
Yeah. You know. I mean, it was on the list because I didn't know what the Wilder Blue was going to end up sounding like. I was just looking for talented people that I would want to be in a band with, like underutilized people who I could bring all together and hopefully maximum utilize. and so whatever, I didn't know if it was going to be like a 90s harmony band, like a Diamond Rio, or if it was going to be more of a bluegrassy thing a little bit, like the Steel Drivers or something, or if it was going to be, I didn't really know what. I just figured whatever it sounds like when we all do our best thing. So we were trying, I remember trying out some fiddle players back in the day, and When He's Out of Sight was one of the ones that we had them learn, and we tried jamming that out. But so for whatever reason, it didn't fit on the first four records, but I always came up on that song on my computer. I'm like, oh man, it's got so many good harmonies and stuff that'd be fun to do. And I finally talked him into it this time. It felt like it fit on this record for whatever reason.
But, oh, it's great.
I think so.
You know, partly because of the fiddle and steel being added to the mix, I think. Because I think that song just wanted a little bit more of that. I think of it as being in the realm of like a Sawyer Brown, Shenandoah type of vibe. It's kind of what I was going for when I wrote it. So it just with fiddle and steel helped that one
move up,
be what it needed to be. Yeah.
And production is so important. You know, it's like if the song is undeniable, then it doesn't really matter sometimes. But I think for most songs, it's like it puts you in the scene of this cowboy vibe. You know, you got to have that steel and got to have that fiddle to me, right?
Yeah. And the harmonica. I mean, when you hear the harmonica on the record, that's Sean.
I did all the harp stuff on the record.
It's sick, dude. I was like,
man. Just when that wafts in, just it puts me right by the campfire, man.
Totally.
Yeah.
And I was listening to the record today, and I was like, how do you come up with all this imagery? Because I'm not a cowboy at all.
Incredible. Yeah. He told me today that somebody on Facebook said he had a spectacular brain, and I agree.
Yeah, it almost sounds like a soundtrack. Like your guys' music in general, I feel
cinematic.
Like.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's cool.
Yeah. I feel like I'm in a more upbeat version of Lonesome Dove or something where I'm just like out on the plane, like
you know, it's pretty easy to get more upbeat than Lonesome Dove.
Yeah. But I don't know. I feel like a cowboy when I listen to it in a cool way. But there's like, you know, it's like some of this, I'm like, it's like Willie Nelson and some Until We Keith Together or something. And then it's like all these different vibes. It's cool. Mm-hmm. It's like a playlist record, like you said.
I love that vibe. It's that Western. It's kind of wide open. And, you know, I'm not a cowboy. Willie Nelson's not a cowboy, you know. But that vibe is just, it's a very American vibe, I feel like. So it's kind of got a roots thing that appeals to me. And so I like to, Sinners and Strays is track one. And that's sort of, I'm in a traveling band of guys that we endure various hardships going all over the place. And we sort of, we make it together, and the song talks about how we're better together, and it reminds me of what I think maybe a group of cowboys or Texas Rangers, you know, like from Lonesome Dove would have been like in the day. It's that camaraderie of the, you know, five guys out there, you know, getting beat up but sticking with it. So that's kind of where my head's at on some of those things, where I don't want to write about being how I'm such a cowboy, because that's not accurate. But if I can use the cowboy way of life that everybody is kind of familiar with as a metaphor for what we do, there are a lot of similarities, you know, in the modern day time, I think.
No one would know. No, I mean, we got, when we were caught in that dust storm in Montana, I had somebody come up to me, because Zane and I were just walking around with bandanas on, just kind of looking around, seeing what was going on, sunglasses, hat, was trying to stay way out of the dust. And I ended up talking to this lady after that, who was just like, "We saw you guys walking around out there." And my friend was like, "Don't worry about them. They're ranchers. They love this." And I was just like, "Well, we love it."
Yeah, yes.
Yes, indeed.
That's super interesting. Thank you.
I will say, we recently played up in Canada, and most of the artists that were on the bill at that event, I think they actually were ranchers. Like, they were doing that on the weekend and then heading back to their ranch.
They don't have a Texas-sized number of gigs like up in Canada.
Yeah. Yeah, it must be Alberta or something.
We were in Ontario. Saskatchewan, yeah.
Right? Yeah.
I mean, there's country everywhere.
No doubt. You
know? Yeah,
that's true.
That's why I think the genre has gotten like so big and so universal. You know, it's like... Mm-hmm. You know, remember the old Brantley Gilbert song, "Country Must Be Countrywide," talking about Ohio, right? But
yeah.
I've been in Ohio. There's a lot of country folks up there.
Everywhere, yeah. Man.
You know?
Everywhere. You can go upstate New York.
Yep.
Or, you know, in the middle of nowhere in eastern Washington, there's some interesting country cats out there. Yeah.
For sure. Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah, there's some interesting people up there. Yeah. Sometimes a little too interesting in some of these spots, but yeah.
And it's, I think, part of... where my head is at is, I think that a lot of people are on the same brain train as I am, where you know, there's something you like about the cowboy way and aesthetic and life, but you're not a cowboy. So how do you bring some of those same aesthetics into your own life, like say toughness or independence or resilience or like being able to just fix stuff and get along? That's what we admire about cowboys, mm-hmm. right? And how do you do that? How do you apply that to the modern day life? And I think it's the same thing with country, quote unquote, country living. It's like, well, okay, I didn't grow up on land. I didn't grow up, that's just, my parents are college professors. We grew up in the suburbs. But what I love about country music is, you know, how it's like plain spoken truth, but just with the perfect words. And I just love the way the fiddle and steel just connect to my soul for some reason, mandolin and dobro. And so it's like, okay, well, how do I make country music even if I'm not out there, you know, living in the mountains? And I play with that a lot, because I don't want to try to portray myself as something I'm not. I'm essentially a kid from the suburbs. And I think a lot of people are.
Yeah,
That's America. These days. Yeah. That is America. We're not, you know, two generations ago, the norm would have been you come from a family farm, you know. But these days, I think the norm is you probably come from a city or a suburb or a town. But what do I admire about the country way of life? Like a slower pace where you know people by their first names and you know, where it's like more centered around the family, and you know, you have maybe multiple generations living close together, and you've got some kind of traditions being passed down. Those, you know, how do I incorporate all that stuff into my music and into my life, even if I don't live on a farm? Which, if I ever have some hits, maybe I'll buy a ranch someday, and maybe I'll be a rancher.
Yeah, there you go. Buy a ranch and hire Rodney to run it for you.
I can only afford a quarter acre of Texas. That's all I can manage.
Well, you spend your time on the Sonic Ranch, so that's right. Good enough for
I
now.
Go to the Sonic.
Yeah, yeah. Spend
pecans
money there.
Are plenty, you know.
It is on a
pecan orchard is
like hundreds of thousands of acres, or tens of thousands of acres. I don't know.
I believe
crazy huge.
I believe it's roughly all the plots together is almost 6,000 acres.
Yeah,
it's a lot,
and it's all pecan orchard. So depending on the time of year you're there, you know, there might just be pecans everywhere. You can just go pick up a pecan and have a little
nutty
snack, and it's nutty, to say the least. You know. It's interesting. It's really interesting. The guy who owns the place, Spacen, you remember his name?
Yeah,
Tony. Yeah. Tony's an interesting cat, right? And he's owned this studio. His family owns this land. And to make a long story short, he's more or less the caretaker of the land now and built this studio 25 years ago on a, you know, a board that he got a real hand-me-down. Like, he paid I think he said 10 grand for this initial board because it was fire sale, needed to be shipped from London, moved it out to the desert in his pecan orchard and started the studio. And, you know, he'll take you on a tour, and if you get high enough, you can see the cartel towns on the other side of the border. He took us to the border the first time we were there, and Border Patrol showed up because they're just like, oh, we know there's seven dudes out here. What are they doing? Mm-hmm. And then they show up, and they're like, oh, it's just Tony. And he's like, I'm just giving him the tour.
Tony.
You know?
Yeah.
Damn, that's crazy. Yeah. I want to go there so bad now.
You should. Dude. I've been trying to reverse engineer the house salsa for a couple months now. I'm getting close.
Oh yeah, the food there is so good. And then there's the constant music of doves.
Some of which made the record as well.
Doing their cooing in the background because I don't know if it's because of the pecans or what, but the place is covered up in doves and birds in general, but especially the doves. So yeah, we on this one song we have, it's called The Hunt. It's about a dove hunt. Lyndon had the idea of sticking a microphone in a tree.
Yeah, they put a really expensive condenser out under this tree.
We ran a cable out the door,
and I think it was a good almost like 15 or 20 minutes worth of audio of Lyndon kind of trudging through the leaves, and you know, he lights a lighter next to it like the guy's smoking a cig and the thing. Yeah. And it's just like, oh yeah, you want to talk about cinematic, let's put some Foley in there.
Yeah. And then, you know, the casual listener of that song, you're just going to hear it a little bit at the beginning, but it kind of weaves its way. Yeah, at the beginning and the end, and it weaves its way throughout the whole song, just that little ambiance. But when I hear that, those doves singing, it takes me back to the Sonic Ranch every time because they're everywhere. And they have these feral cats. Well, I say feral, they're
semi-feral.
Yeah, semi-feral cats that are all over the place, and they're always...
They'll come sit on you in the studio.
Chomping on a dove or whatever.
Or yeah, first thing in the morning, you turn the corner, there's just a pile of feathers outside the studio door. Because the cat's like, well, I don't have anything to do till the guys get here. I might as well hunt some dove.
That's what I love about Sonic Ranch. I know we're talking a lot about it, but it's that mix of, it's kind of highbrow. Tony has taste in art, and so there's art, and it's kind of got this funky, artist-y, you know, decoration style, but you're also just kind of in the desert in Texas in these kind of rundown adobe buildings. And I love that juxtaposition of, it just feels real down home and in the middle of nowhere, but it's also got every piece of vintage gear you could ever want. And the engineer that we use there, Mario, really knows his stuff. So I love being in a great studio, but just kind of in a down home atmosphere with, you know, cats running around. The cats are very friendly. They'll climb up in your lap. They're like crawling all on the Neve console, and I'm like, oh my gosh. Yeah. That's your cat? Because my cat pukes a lot. I'm just imagining a cat puking on that board, and that gets expensive.
Yeah, I don't want to imagine that.
But he, Mario said their cat never pukes on the board.
Let alone, I mean, they've got vintage.
Knock on wood.
Vintage Universal Audio. This is, you know, this rack, you're just watching the cat like, I don't know, man. If he like slips, he'll turn a knob, and then we'll be screwed. That never happens.
Did you guys write there, or just get all the songs together and go cut?
So far, the only song that's ever been written at Sonic Ranch was Supernatural.
Yeah, we did. We did write one when Brent Cobb was with us.
But none of these most recent ones. We all did that a few months prior. Mm-hmm. All the newest tunes on the record got written in October of last year.
We went on a songwriter retreat, and we brought the whole band, and we brought in some, similar to bringing in the outside musicians, we brought in some outside songwriters that we sort of know and respect from Texas and Nashville, and we just kind of hung out, wrote some tunes.
Yeah, maybe someone I know was talking about how they did that. Maybe it was Delaney?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Delaney, she came Ramsdale. Out with us.
Yeah.
Delaney, Aaron Ratier,
Phoenix Mendoza, and Charlie Stout.
And Charlie Stout, yeah.
It's a good crew right there.
Yeah.
It was something.
Yeah, y'all had a good time, huh?
Yeah, I mean, You got to be careful if you get in too long a conversation with Charlie about certain topics.
I've never met him, but I've heard that.
He's one of my favorite people, but he's a funny guy.
That's right. They're all fun. I mean, Aaron is hilarious.
Aaron is especially hilarious.
He is wild.
All four of those people are really fun people to be around. So, yeah. We just kind of split up into groups of three every morning. Well, we would start the day by everyone go off by themselves and write a song in 30 minutes and then come back and play it for the group.
Whoa. And it was like summer camp. Like,
it was a good prime. It was a great primer.
It was just, it doesn't have to be good, but just get the pump going, get some, realize that it's not that hard. You can come up with some stuff. So we would do that, and then we would split into groups of three, do that for 3 or 4 hours, have lunch, and split everybody up into different groups of three and do that afternoon.
We really did get a lot of songs written in 2 days. So, it's like almost 12 songs, not to mention the everybody's 30-minute songs. I mean, Charlie wrote that one, the opening for the opening band song.
Yeah.
Still sticks in my craw. Kind of want him to record that.
Right. So it was an intense couple of days because that's a lot of brain work. But we got a bunch of tunes out of it. And then, of course, then we sort of, I think only 3 or 4 of those ended up making the record.
Yeah.
We kind of threw those in the pile of songs that we already had. And
I mean, one of the Good Woman was from, is probably 4 or 5 years old now, I think.
Yeah.
We had made a demo of that tune on the bus before I was any good at playing the harmonica. It still came out a pretty good demo and was tough to beat, honestly, because I had to relearn how to play it.
Demo-itis.
a little bit of demo-itis. It took some doing to kind of like finesse it into a thing that felt like it beat the demo, yeah.
Yeah. The harmonica playing on the record's great.
Yeah, I'm not trying to talk about it.
Okay. I'm hearing a lot more vocally on the record. It seems like we get a lot more singers coming in. So good. You guys want to talk about that a little bit?
Zane?
Sure. Well, when you got a band where all five people sing, I mean, I'm just always racking my brain to think of more opportunities of how to get everybody involved, because I think it's one of the things that is the most fun for us. It makes us maybe a little different than a lot of what's going on. So, I mean, like Chasing the Sun is an example of a tune that we wrote at that writer's retreat. In fact, it was when Phoenix did his 30-minute song that morning, Chasing the Sun was his idea. And it was, he wasn't able to finish it all the way up, but they thought it was good enough that he, Andy, and Paul finished that up that morning. And that one has that kind of, I don't know, it's almost a little bit Beach Boys, but I think it's a little bit 70s, I don't know, whatever. But it's got lots of harmonies for sure, group vocals. Yeah. So one thing that we did on that one is
Andy played bass.
Yeah, Andy played bass, and Sean came up with a guitar part idea.
Yeah.
But vocally, we do a thing where Andy is singing lead on that with me, so we're doubling each other on the lead. And that, I think that's a good technique that we use sometimes. We got some other songs where Paul and I will sometimes double the lead. And what that does is my voice is not so featured and pokey-outy. It's more buried in a mix, and it sounds a lot more, I think, just like a group, which is, I think, a cool mode for us to be in, and it definitely fits that particular tune.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we get pretty nerdy about that stuff, because we've got, normally you have 3 notes in a chord, you got melody, and then you could go a high harmony above that, or usually a baritone below, or you could do the baritone an octave up, which put 2 above, and then any of those can be doubled, and if you want, you can do the second high and the low, which would be octaves of each other.
Yeah.
And so, and then,
or
and
doubles if, and splits. Yeah, we can split, do a lot of stuff with 5 people.
Do suspensions and sevenths and ninths. And so we're always working on, you and Andy switch parts. And I mean, this is what we do for like hours. Oh, we're sitting around, we're just like, well, let's try Paul on Andy's part. Yeah. And Andy, you double Zane again. No, that's not right. It was sounding good. What were we doing? Okay, you back to Sean. An octave above Zane, and then Andy and Paul below that, and then
someone at the piano sort of banging the parts out, or
Sometimes, but a lot
mostly of Lyndon has it in his head.
Yeah, a lot of times, like, so sometimes Zane will bring in a song where he's got kind of a prepared set of ideas and we'll kind of finesse them to make them work for us. Mm-hmm. And other times, well, yeah, we'll just sit there and just hammer through the process of being like, well, does it sound better if you sang this? Does it sound better if he sang this? What if you switch parts? What if we switch these parts? What if we decide to completely get rid of those and do this other thing? And it does take some time.
You'll never know how painful it is to make this music. The listener will never know.
And thank goodness.
Yeah, I'm familiar.
It's supposed to sound like you meant everything that happened in advance. You know, because people, that's the thing. That's another thing. I forget what I was even listening to, but somebody was just like, you know, you go through all this trouble of producing a record and deciding what it's supposed to be and being uncertain about this or whatever. I was listening to Jay talk about making Super Troopers where he was just like, I don't really know it. These things make me laugh. I don't know if they work. I don't know what this, that, or the other. But the audience, the listener or the viewer, you know, when they come upon it for the first time, what they hear is what they assume you intended to do from day one. Right. Whether that's true or not, That's what their experience as a listener is. And so right. Sometimes I think that can be, it's easy to get lost in the sauce and not think, well, the audience is just going to be like, well, this is what it was supposed to sound like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whether it was or not.
Yeah, but there's a little happy accidents and different right. things along the way. When you guys play a show, do you guys do like a group vocal warm up or do you guys?
We ought to. We did for a little while.
No, man. No, we don't.
Because like when I first started playing with Luke, he would just go in cold and sing the show, and it was perfect. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, and then when I was playing for Michael Ray back in the day, we were on the Darius Rucker tour, and yeah. they would get together as a band and sing songs and work up, just do their harmonies. Nowadays with Luke, it's like they listen to like the, you know, 30-minute warm-up on YouTube where it's like, Mommy made me mash my M&Ms mm-hmm. or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
and
yeah, yeah,
and so
yeah.
So you guys
yeah.
are just like, just go out there and just rip it.
Yeah. It's kind of every man for himself.
It is a little bit. There was a while where we were doing some vocal warm-ups. Mm-hmm. At least two or three of us
the
would get in on it
at
once.
The reason we quit is because, honestly, we were like, okay, guys, let's get together. And we'd be like, on the angry waves. Oh, sounds good. All right. Yeah.
Like, don't waste the good one on the warm up, you know?
Hell yeah.
But Lyndon does, he's a believer in the vocal warm up. So you'll often find him doing that on the bus. And you know, we all know the tape by heart now. And so sometimes people
get in on a few yaws.
Yeah, yeah. A few of those. But,
yeah.
Yeah.
Now put your tongue on the roof of your mouth.
Yeah, this his is this lady, and I don't know, maybe it's just me, but everything she says sounds a little dirty. She's like, now place the tip of your tongue gently. That's it.
Oh, just, yeah.
It's like, uh-huh. Everything she says is just like, what are we listening to
oh,
here?
Oh, boy, bro? I'm ready for the show. I'm so ready for the show.
Anyway, I've what I've found is that my voice tends to go downhill during a show, like, or just through the day. I wake up in the morning with all this low, you know, resonance,
sultry, just
resonance, and yeah, and then as the day goes on, and I eat stuff and yell and sing, as I get more hoarse, and so I'm usually just like, I don't really, I kind of want to save it up for the show, you know, but I think other people just have a different experience than that, you know.
It's a little hit or miss for me. Sometimes, sometimes the set will be like, there's some really intense, some high intensity stuff early, and I always feel like, oh man, if that was three or four songs later in the set, I would feel a lot more solid about my right. consistency.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And I finagled that a couple times, and I, you know, anecdotally it worked. So it kind of just like, well, maybe we move that back, be a little better off.
No doubt. Yeah.
But
you're not coming out with like, I Will Always Love You as the first song or whatever.
Thankfully, right. No.
Are you also doing the anthem?
Occasionally. Basis, yeah, we'll do it occasionally on request. Or we didn't do it for the 4th of July, did we? That
Not on the 4th, no, because they had a
they had that firefighter lady from the
armed forces lined up to do it, and she did great. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we are always down to do it, and we love doing it. And that's an example of a sort of an arrangement that I came up with on my own at home. I just sang all the parts in GarageBand and got it close, and then when I brought it to the band, it was just a matter of who's going to sing which part and kind of make it some tweaks to make it fit better.
Yeah, just minor stuff.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite parts of the show, like of all the show, the whole day, like when we're all on tour together, it was fun.
Oh, thanks, yeah, man.
It was killer. In 4, right? That's how you guys do it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Which until you pointed that out the last time we were on this podcast, that had never occurred to me.
He just did it. No big deal, whatever. Just this is how it is.
Yeah, he's right. Yeah, that is in 4/4, I guess. And I guess normally it's not. Okay.
Well, that's the other nice thing about it. It's like it's not imposing in any way that it's not a waltz like you would expect. You just kind of just go with it because most people don't know anyway.
You don't hear what drums is like usually anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I just.
There's no backbeat to tell me what time this is in.
I was just pretending, like, okay, what if this was a Zane Williams song that I wrote? How would I, like, play it on the guitar and sing it?
That's why there aren't many Zane Williams waltzes.
And apparently I would do it 4/4.
Yeah. Yeah. Another happy accident, right?
Another That's happy killer. Accident, yeah.
What are you guys have been talking about, you know, playing the clubs. Like, let's talk about your touring that you've been doing. I mean, of course, last time I saw you, it was inside of the stadium, which was awesome. And like you said, the thing that makes your guys' show so different is the vocals and the combination of the level of talent you guys have, not just in musicianship, but in vocalists is unmatched in pretty much any genre. But like, what kind of rooms have you guys been playing recently?
Small to medium, baby. to medium when we're the headliner.
Yeah.
We recently sold out the Globe Hall Theater in Denver. Big whoop, man. There's 250 people, but dadgummit, it was fun.
Yeah,
you know, they were all there to see us, and they were, and we've played there several times and never sold it out until this most recent one. So, we've had a bunch of just clubs like that that we've, you know, been hacking away at for a good amount of time, and we're just kind of experiencing that slow but steady growth.
It's still nice to be a play in a sold out place like Globe and ask, has anybody ever seen us? And still there's people that are just like, I've never seen you. I talked to one chick who had never heard of us ever. And her friends were just like, we have to go see the show. She's like, all of my friends know about you and I don't.
I will say that you will
after this. I don't know.
There's some bands where it's like you got to study the material before you go in, but you can go into a Wilder Blues show and not know one song and leave extremely happy.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't know why people know those songs and try and sing along.
I think that's because, we're
awesome.
I was going to say something about the opposite. But anyway. But yeah, I will say, you know, so I'm buddies. I was talking with Mike Tuck the other day in Jake Worthington's band, and he was like, yeah, man, we haven't played anything longer than a 45-minute set the whole time I've been with them, you know, because they're doing a lot of opening stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's cool. There's part of me that's envious of wanting to be out there just opening in some big show all the time. But I would say, you know, for every 45-minute set that we do at some festival somewhere or as an opening act, we probably do 2 or 3 where we're the headliner in a smaller club, and we do our, you know, 90-minute plus encore. Ends up being about a 2-hour show, and I would miss that, man, if I got away from that too long.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, 45 minutes just ain't long enough to go through our songs. You're just like, oh, dang, we never play this one anymore. We never play that one. So
You're cutting off the mixtape early, you know.
You got 5 records.
Yeah.
Well, it doesn't make the set lists any easier either.
I mean, my whole goal would be if we could ever draw 500 to 1,000 people nationwide, then I'm done. It would be all downhill from there. But as it is, we're not quite there yet, so we're just plugging away and seeing that slow but steady growth. And We are, I will say, to the point where I don't play very many like lame gigs anymore, where it's like a sports bar and like everybody's ignoring you because I've done that.
Mexican restaurant.
So many
menu venue, baby. Hit me with the nearest menu venue. I'm ready for dinner.
Menu venue. Normally we play, thank God, we play real music venues that support nationally touring artists, but they're just like the smaller places.
Yeah,
you know,
Those are my favorite spots.
Those places are pretty great, pretty freaking
the
cool.
Best.
Yeah,
and it's neat to look at the walls on those places and see all the people that have played there in the past. You know, because you might see a Luke Combs poster or certainly the Red Clay Strays have played almost all those places fairly recently, and so you know we're just out there keeping it real, I guess you could say, but that's not that. The stadium thing that Luke does is any less real. I mean, it's just his music certainly connected on a big scale, and ours is a little bit more of a niche thing right now, and that's fine, man. We're able to pay our bills and we're able to keep doing it, and so that's all I ever wanted 25 years ago, back before the turn of the century.
Well, and honestly, that's getting harder and harder. You know, these new artists trying to, you know, cut their teeth, can't get on the road, not losing money.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, and I hesitate to use this phrase grandfathered in, no offense, Zane, because I know you ain't no granddad. But I remember when we first started, we were playing at the Saxon, and I had this shower thought about it. It's like, oh, man, if every car in the country goes electric, then no 22-year-old will be able to buy an electric van that could tour them out of their rough 200-mile radius. And so touring will end. I was like, oh, gosh, that's a scary thought. And there is a little bit of that actually happening. I mean, we've been doing it. We'd already been doing it so long, and the infrastructure that we had when we started this band was already so built in that we could just push on. But if you were starting today, it sounds much, much, much harder to do.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, it's like getting the tickets sold and having the bus and the all that other stuff. It's a, gosh, it just seems so much more complicated than it used to be, but
yeah,
I don't know.
It's always been a chicken and egg problem,
you know,
because almost a lot of the guys that I know that have made it big, they had like some early investor that lost money on them.
Yeah.
And that's funny, you know, to think back if you were, I don't want to name any names since that's sort of a negative example,
yeah, don't
but
do
I'm
that.
Talking about somebody that gave them, you know, that invested 50 grand or something to help them get that van and for me, I can talk about my own story. For me, it was this independent label called B Music, and they purchased my first three records that I had made on my own, Zane Williams Records, and they wanted to buy those masters. And so they paid me 40 grand for those three albums. I mean, 40 for all three of them. And I took that 40 grand and I bought a van and a trailer and a sound system. And without that, I don't know how I would have been able to go on the road.
Yeah.
And they also kicked in some money above that to help me pay for like this, you know, my first guitar player was kind of more expensive than what I could really afford. And so they helped me on that, and they went bankrupt. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Long story short, it's over.
Yeah, artist development's tough.
It's
I want to buy a Zane record.
It's the music business, y'all. It's, you know, how do you make $1 million? You start with two.
Yep.
No doubt. Yeah,
that's true.
It's rough out there. But the ones of us that are like the Kojos and Lukes and us that are still doing it, it's like you find some way of keeping it going, you know, and making it make sense. And at our level, we just keep our expenses down. We drive our own bus. We, you know, we load our own gear and we
make a few new fans everywhere we go.
Design our own merch and do all those things. I've sort of handed a lot of that off these days, but still wear all the hats that you got to wear and just figure out how to do it, you know. And then, you know, what is this? Poverty in a way is freedom, right? Because you're you don't have anything to lose. You can take a chance on the next album because, I mean, you're already poor. What's going to happen?
Right. Yeah. What's the worst that could happen?
Justin Cal would do, you know? Yeah. That's cowboy for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love it.
And I mean, realistically, that's art, you know? Like, you shouldn't be making art to service financial gain.
Well, it's like most painters, you know, they don't get famous until after they're dead or whatever. And their paintings sell for, you know, hundreds of thousands of millions of dollars or whatever, but they were just dirt poor and penniless when they died.
In a mental institution.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I want to buy a Mark Rothko as much as the next guy, but I can't afford it.
So what's the actual date of the record dropping here?
August 28th.
Go check it out, right?
Yes, please.
That's what we need. I see we've got a whole slew of dates here to go check the boys out.
We got a whole slew of dates. If you go to thewilderblue.com, you can see them all because we don't remember them.
Yeah.
Too many to mention. I know we're going on tour with Paul Coffin in November. That's so
great. We are going doing some opening shows in California with Paul in November, which would be fun. A couple double dose of Texas rhythm out west.
If you don't see your state on the list, just wait. We'll be there next year.
That's true.
Okay. Are you guys playing Nashville? You don't have it memorized.
Well, next year, we tried to get a Nashville one for this year, and it just didn't quite pan out. So we'll be back next year for sure.
We'll probably play the Opry one more time this year, I think, maybe.
I'm also into that.
We're working on
that. Oh, yeah.
Sounds great.
Another chance to go to Duke's and get a hot Italian.
Dude, call me. That's my hood, dude. I'll go to Duke's with the boys.
Shit, yeah.
Get a sandwich.
I had one last night. It was the wrong thing to eat right before I went to bed.
Oh, yeah.
I feel that most times.
Well, appreciate you guys coming and hanging with us, man.
Yeah.
The new record, it fucking rips. You guys did great. It's awesome.
Appreciate that.
So, guys, go listen to it. On the 28th.
August 28th, Cinco. We got a couple singles out already.
How hard could it be?
I mean, who knows? By the time this comes out, it might already be out. You've just been waiting too long.
Maybe.
Get out on the highway, put it in self-driving mode, and then put on the mixtape.
Put on the Wilder Blue mixtape, the new one, Cinco.
What's that movie, that Disney animated movie in the future? WALL-E.
Yeah.
Just like that with like the record playing on, Texas Women's jamming.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Sign me up. Just rolling around in your floating chair.
Maybe after we're dead, then our music will get real popular and it'll look exactly like that.
And I'll have bought all the Zane Williams records and I'll be a millionaire.
Hologram Water Blue.
I'm into it. My license is ready to buy, baby.
There you go. All right, y'all. Well, my name's Kurt Ozon.
I'm Nick Tressler.
And we'll see you on the front row. Thanks, boys.
Thanks.